Hello, I'm Patricia Camilleri. Welcome to this, the last programme in the series entitled The Artifact. Over the last weeks, I've been speaking to some of Malta's key archaeologists about the many facets of archaeology and about particular projects which they've been working on or are planning for the future. My guest today is Mr. Keith Buhajar. Keith was educated at De La Salle College in Cotonera. In 1993, he enrolled at the University of Malta in the Department of Classics and Archaeology and obtained his BA honours in 1997. After completion of his PGCE, he started teaching at Stella Maris College in Gzira, Geography and Environmental Studies. But he went on studying and got his MA in November 2003. The very interesting title of his thesis was Medieval and Early Modern Cave Settlements and Water Galleries in Northwest Malta, South of the Great Fault, a field survey and gazetteer. And it was a sort of first attempt at coming to terms with the rural archaeology of late medieval Malta. His area of expertise is the archaeology of the Maltese countryside, with special emphasis on cave-dwelling phenomenon, which is what we're going to be speaking about today, and the related water management systems he's currently reading for his PhD, and his research centres around medieval settlement distribution in Malta. Welcome, Keith. So, cave dwellings, that's a really fascinating subject. I know that there have been many visitors to Malta in the past, and many of them in the 19th century, who found the cave dwelling in Malta very interesting. And we have some, I think, even some paintings to prove it. Tell us, what captured your interest in Maltese late medieval cave dwelling communities?
Well, I started taking an active interest in caves for a variety of reasons. In the first place, there were quite a few accounts about cave dwelling in Malta. Mainly the accounts, the very short account by Gianfrancesca Bela and by Athanasius Kircher, both dating to the 1600s. But then, way back in 1995, I was involved through Professor Mario Buhajar in the discovery of the Simblia Church and the adjoining cave settlement. So that is really, I think, what led me onto the subject. And then I was further encouraged by Professor Mario Buhajar. So I pursued that subject and started realizing how unstudied it was as yet. So there was and there still is quite some work to be done on that subject. So really it was that particular environment which led me onto cave settlements. And secondly, I was quite familiar with the Maltese countryside and started realizing that in particular areas of the island, mainly towards the northwest of the north and northwest areas of the island, there were quite a lot of cave enclaves, which started to hint the presence of local rural troglodytic communities. And by the word troglodyte, I mean people inhabiting in caves. So this is what led me to start looking at cave settlements at the various types of caves in more detail. Mm-hmm. And that led to the formulation of various cave typologies, so on and so forth.
So what do we know now about these troglodyte communities? I mean, we have these reports that were written up, as you say, as early as the 17th century. So sort of what do we know about them, really?
So, unfortunately, the reports tell us only or give us only a very, very light glimpse as to what living in caves must have been. Because unfortunately, the only documented cave was Aril Gbir, because it had captured the interest of Athanasius Kircher way back in 1637 and Gianfrancesca Bela, who published an account, a very brief account, on Aril Gbir in his Della Descrizione de Malta, dating back to 1647. And, for instance, Kircher tells us how, while he was dining at the Verdella Palace, the Grand Master mentioned the presence of a nearby troglodytic community, and presumably Kircher expressed his interest in being shown around these caves, so he was taken to visit the community, and he recounts how at the entrance to the caves he was met by surprisingly tall but simply dressed men and women. They were dressed in goatskins, apparently. These people were vegetarians. In actual fact, they refused to touch any meat that was sent over from what was left of the meal by the grandmaster. They apparently made cheese, and they owned herds. The males were apparently herdsmen, whilst the chores that the women took care of were baking bread, making cheese, and tending the children. This community apparently listened or attended mass in nearby Dingley. And it is also presumably the place where they were selling their livestock or some of their produce. Kircher also tells us how these people were storing water in large earthenware pitchers, how they decorated their caves with holy pictures and crosses, how they had ventilation holes, presumably to get rid of smoke from the cave interior, and how they could open and close these ventilation shafts by means of wooden apertures or whatever they were. So that is the glimpse into the life at Arilgbir that Kircher gives us. Gianfrancesca Bela adds slightly more information to the story by telling us that there were about 27 families living in Arilgbir, and the community there amounted to around 117 people. And Arilgbir was apparently inhabited by what Abela described as Pastoria Pecorai. So that is all the information that we know about Arilgbir, and it happens to be the best documented cave settlement that we've got on the island. So my point of departure were these two accounts. Then I came across another account dating back to 1793 by a certain Carlo Gastone di Terra di Razzonico, who also wrote about the Arilgbir community. And surprisingly, whilst in 1647 there were about 117 people living in Arilgbir, in 1793 there was only one person, apparently well over 80, who was known as a certain Dane, and who had only access to one cave in the Arilgbir complex. And apparently the remaining caves were under direct control of the Grand Master, of the Knights of St. John. So that was my point of departure. And then I started taking a deeper look into these cave settlement units, their related landscape, because when looking at caves, you can't just look at one cave or at a group of caves. You've got to look at the whole surrounding landscape, at the whole surrounding environment. And actually, I've started realizing that we're talking about cave enclaves, a cave community, a cave village. And in actual fact, it is more than evident when visiting Simblia, which is on the outskirts of Dingley. It is actually perched on the southern side of Witter Room, which is quite a fascinating valley, really, which has some spectacular views of the Imtarfa region. That you've got various villages that still survive in their embryonic form, like, for instance, how Birkirkar or Abba or several other Maltese Rahal place names would have looked like in their infancy, while they were still very small communities. So that started me giving me a better insight onto how these settlements might have looked like.
Mm-hmm. And why would people have actually wanted to live in caves? In actual fact, there must have been advantages, presumably, as well as to our eyes, obviously, disadvantages. But there must have been advantages for people to live in caves.
Well, that's a very good question. In the first place, a cave must be perceived as being a normal house. It was meant, I think, to reflect a normal house. In actual fact, when you encounter a very large cave, that large cave was partitioned into a series of smaller spaces meant to represent rooms. So the exterior of caves was screened off by means of a dry stone wall, and the only means of access was a narrow doorway. In most cases, caves would lack any window openings on their screening facade, but the interior of caves would still be screened off or partitioned off by means of dry stone walls. And when I use the term dry stone walling, I mean the use of stone walls which lack the use of mortar. So caves must have been meant to reflect an above-ground house. They were, in some instances, whitewashed on their interior and exterior. They contained some wooden fittings, so they were meant to reflect a more or less comfortable dwelling. And I think people chose caves as places in which to live due to the fact that they were influenced by their surrounding environment. In the first place, I think that caves were much cheaper to dig than to construct a normal above-ground house. You did not have any expenses incurred in the sense that you didn't have to buy any masonry. You did not have to transport any masonry over long distances. You did not have to acquire any timber beams in order to roof your cave. So I think there was much less, there were much less expenses involved. And secondly, having a cave was something more permanent in the sense that if your village was sporadically attacked by pirates, much less damage could have been done to a cave than to an above-ground house. And a cave would have certainly also demanded much less maintenance than an above-ground house. And last but not least, I think that a cave settlement must also be considered in the sense that it blends so well with its surrounding environment that it's usually located or it's usually dug into a cliff face that it's much more difficult to detect than an above-ground house. So if you're dealing with someone who's not familiar with a particular landscape, it's much more difficult to detect a cave than detecting an above-ground house that immediately stands out in the landscape. So that is one of the most important reasons, I think, why people must have opted to live in caves. And then there are other practical reasons. People who lived in caves generally tend to be found to the north and northwest sections of the island. And this is because people were looking at a practical aspect. Caves are usually dug into an upper coralline deposit, but which is specifically known as of the Imtarfa member type. Now, what is so special about this Imtarfa member stratum of the upper coralline deposit is the fact that it is quite brittle and very easy to dig. So these people were being practical. And I've tend to notice that when looking at the location of the various cave settlements, you would tend to notice that in areas where you've got exposed Imtarfa member deposits, you tend to find a large concentration of caves. Whereas in areas where you find a complete absence of Imtarfa member deposits, you will tend to find very little or no cave settlements at all. And therefore, people were being very practical in managing to identify this rock deposit, realizing its potential, and just choosing to dig their houses or dig their homes into this specific rock deposit.
Before continuing to discuss cave dwellings in Malta, for those listeners who might only just have joined us, I'd like to tell you that this is The Artifact. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I'm talking to Keith Buhajar about cave dwellings in Malta. The caves that you've spoken about, you said they're in the north, mostly in the northwest of the...
North and northwest of the island.
Are there differences between types of cave? Does it...
So there are two basic differences, two basic cave typologies, because looking at the caves that we've got present in the Maltese landscape, I've tended to classify caves into cliff-face settlements, which consist of caves that are dug into a cliff face, and karst feature settlements. Now, these two types of caves are substantially different in the sense that karst feature settlements are natural geologic structures that are present in the landscape. They form mainly due to the fact that Our limestone is carboniferous in nature. It contains quite a lot of carbon, being composed of the remains of dead organisms. So when it rains, the rain droplets, while still traveling through the atmosphere, tend to absorb some quantities of carbon dioxide, which turn the water into a very weak type of carbonic acid. And this carbonic acid reacts with the surface of the limestone in order to form cave pockets underground, hollows, which, when the roof of these caves would collapse, it tends to create a substantially large, at times, natural rock hollow or natural rock depression. For instance, Dweira was formed in this particular way. Ma'luba in the limits of Rendi was formed in an identical manner. Aril Gbir was also formed in such a way. But the main difference between karst feature settlements and cliff face settlements is the fact that there are very little karst feature settlements in Malta. So there was only limited use for such settlements. And one other fact that does not have to be overlooked is the fact that such settlements are located in lower coral limestone or upper coral limestone. So it's a type of rock that was much harder to cut and quarry. So there was only limited intervention that one could do in order to enlarge his cave. So the majority by far of cave settlements that we've got on the island are of the cliff face type. And people were living in cliff settlements simply because of the fact that they were cultivating the fields below their caves. So it was quite convenient for them to be living in a vantage location, in a high up location, from which they could have a good control of what was happening in the underlying fields. And I've also realized that in an intermediate stage between the cave and the first field terrace, you also find a water source, a perennial water source, which these people were using to their advantage to irrigate the fields.
This is something that really fascinated me when you took us out at the Archaeological Society, had a site visit, and you kindly took us out to have a look at these water courses, these perched aquifers. And I must say that I've walked the Maltese countryside quite a bit over the last 30 years, but I just wasn't aware of these at all, and so I was absolutely fascinated to have you there to tell us about it. Because, of course, for people like that, the water source would have been extremely important, vital, really,
vital.
Really. And so you had a combination of a place where they could conveniently have their cave with the kind of stone that would give them the opportunity also to modify it perhaps slightly, mm-hmm. And at the same time be in a rock situation that also gave them the water source
as
well.
That's the point. And Malta is perceived by many people as being quite an arid country, but I think there's enough evidence in hand to show that this conception can be changed slightly, because there are areas in Malta where there are particular geologic deposits where water is retained by, for instance, blue clay in the form of the perched aquifer all year round. And this water, this perched aquifer reserve, would be replenished each winter. And people, since antiquity, have realized that there are rock-bearing strata. So this must have encouraged them to dig very narrow but long tunnels into a cliff face in order to tap this perched aquifer and retrieve a water source right to the foot of the actual cliff where the settlement was located. And this would have really facilitated irrigation. For instance, in the areas in the northwest of Malta, which I have studied, I've got ample evidence in hand to prove that farmers, which still own these galleries, these water galleries, can in fact get 3 crop yields a year, and not 2, as is the case with the farmers who own fields which are not irrigated. So having a water gallery inside your property would have been of an economic value, of a greater economic value.
Perhaps you could explain for our listeners briefly just how the perched aquifer works.
Okay, so in Malta we've got five main different rock layers, which are the upper coral limestone, green sands, the blue clay deposit, the globigerina limestone, and the lower coral limestone. Now, what concerns us with the perched aquifer are the first three geological deposits, which are the upper coral limestone, the green sands, and the blue clay, because all three deposits are permeable to water. All first two deposits are permeable to water. That is, the upper coral limestone and green sands allow water percolation. But because of the fine-grained nature of the blue clay, water won't manage to pass through. So that forms an impermeable layer above which water collects. So what these troglodytic communities did was that they discovered that above the Mtalfa member deposit, only about 1 or 2 meters below the Mtalfa member deposit, there was this blue clay, and therefore you had water gathering above that deposit in the form of the perched aquifer. So they often dug these galleries, these narrow galleries, because when viewed from the outside, you would only be looking at a very narrow opening that is often about 60 to 80 centimeters wide and about 1.5 meters high, which would consist of a very narrow tunnel or a very narrow gallery that would be moving at 90 degrees to the actual cliff face in order to tap a supply of water. And when the aquifer was tapped, usually a channel or a canal used to be hewn at the bottom of the actual gallery, and stone masonry canals would then transport water from the entrance of the gallery down to the terraced fields below. So by just opening and closing your canal network, you could actually choose or direct water to the fields that needed to be irrigated.
And the water was there practically all year round.
It was a perennial water source. Actually, there are water fluctuations, water level fluctuations between the summer and winter months, but it's still a perennial water source.
And still used today.
And still used today in most instances.
In fact, what fascinated me was that I had never really noticed these constructions, and it has a very interesting sort of roofing system, doesn't it? Perhaps you could describe that a little bit, how it works, the tunnel.
So in the first place, there are instances where the tunnel had to be roofed in its initial phases, simply because a field would have been built above the actual tunnel. But usually, a tunnel would be entirely rock-cut. And what's interesting about the system is that it's quite similar to any recent system of irrigation, which was invented probably by the Persians, by the ancient Persians, which is known most commonly as the Anat system, the Anat water system. And it's a system which was perhaps, but I'm still not sure about this point, there's still much more research that has to be done about this fact, that it's a system that perhaps was introduced into Malta at around 800-900 years ago by the Arabs from Sicily, presumably. And the Arabs, who continued spreading this Anat system in northern Africa, they introduced it into Spain and possibly even into Sicily, because Palermo claims that it has got its own Anat systems. The Arabs used to call this system the invention of summer, simply because it used to allow the growing of a third crop during the dry summer months. And the amount of water that the Anats produced is simply something fascinating, because you would be present in a dry landscape during the middle of August, and you've still got this perennial water source flowing out of your gallery.
Wonderful. Just a word about what happened to the people who lived in these caves.
So, people continued living in caves, in a number of caves, till the beginning of the 20th century. For instance, there was an archaeologist friend of mine whose father from Meliha was born in one of these caves. So, what happened was that, unfortunately, people started thinking that if you lived in cave meant that you are coming from a lower stratification of society. So because of this social label that was being attached to people inhabiting in caves, probably farming communities also started becoming wealthier. So people started abandoning the actual cave, they stuck to the surrounding area and they started building their house in the area fronting the actual cave, and caves were then converted into animal pens.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of today's programme, and sadly, to the end of this series. I'd like to thank Keith Buhajar for being with us on this occasion and for talking to us about cave dwellings, which I think is fascinating. We could have gone on for a lot longer. I'd also at this point like to thank all my guests who kindly gave their time to participate in the artefact, and to Campus FM for hosting us. I hope that the programmes have kindled or rekindled the listeners' interest in Maltese archaeology. The narratives are absolutely fascinating. There are stories that need to be told, and not simply because they are of historic interest to Malta, but because they're of interest on a European scale and on a world scale. Each group of inhabitants has left their style of life, their pottery, their architecture, their networking patterns, of which we spoke last week with Nathaniel Kutayar. These people left us their art, their technology, their cultural mores. The study of archaeology gives them their rightful place in our past. Until next time we meet, this is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.